Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the January monthly policy update. I'm Jamie Tucker with Independent Sector. Today, I'm joined in the field by Heather Mead of Washington Council Arts and Young. Heather, thanks for being with us. Before we get into today's agenda, I want to go over a few housekeeping items. As you notice, we've gone to a conference call format this month. It's really kind of an opportunity to test this out a bit to see if there are ways to make this even more interactive for those of you on the phone. And as of right now, your lines are unmuted. So we do ask you, please mute your lines either via the mute function or *6. You can press #6 to unmute. We hope that you'll want to ask some questions. We'll certainly provide our opportunities throughout the call for you to do so. And we'll manage those throughout. If you're having any technical difficulties, Jackie Brennan is helping us out this month. Her direct line is 202-467-6167. So Jackie Brennan at 202-467-6171 if you're having any issues with the call today. And we look forward to your questions. Glad to have you on. Glad to be back with the monthly policy update. We are excited to do this. I know there was some conversation at the end of last year about suspending these potentially during the first 100 days, as we are continuing to do the podcast and a few other touch points. But we do see the value, at least every month, and having an opportunity to come talk with you about the issues taking place here in D.C. and maybe taking a deeper dive than we would be able to otherwise. And please also note the scheduling change. These calls will now be taking place on the last Thursday of every month. So we'll see you again on the last Thursday of February after this month, and we'll provide ample opportunity to promote the calls moving forward. So we're going to jump right into the agenda. And first thing we want to talk about, and I'll engage Heather a bit on this, is we have a new administration. Certainly we're only about a week into it. But there's been a flurry of activity from the executive office, particularly with executive orders, freezes on rulemaking and regulations. Heather, I'm wondering if just very broadly you can help us unpack a bit kind of the frenetic pace we've seen in the first few days and how that might compare to the prior administration, at least in terms of how they're setting the agenda.
Thanks so much, Jamie. I think a couple of things to keep in mind as we're looking at this. I think the things that we're seeing come out of the White House, and there have been a number of them. They started out with the executive order on the Affordable Care Act, limiting the implementation of the taxes and fees and the regulatory burden associated with the ACA, the Dakota Access Pipeline, limiting contributions to organizations that provide abortions internationally, TPP, a federal hiring freeze. These pieces of sort of presidential policy, I guess we'll call them, were campaign promises. These were things that he campaigned on, that he told his supporters he would do, and we expected that there would be some early action on these items because those were part of the agenda. There are also things that are hard to move quickly through a legislative process, and so putting out your priorities early through executive orders is not actually uncommon in a presidency. In fact, some of these items that were reinstated by President Trump were things that had actually been done early in the administration by other previous presidents, such as President Bush, like the Mexico City funding. I think one other thing to keep in mind is that the implementation of these orders varies greatly depending on what the order was, whether or not the order requires legislative action or regulatory action to actually put into force the orders and the policies that were contained in the memos. So there will be some different implementation for each one of these items as we watch them go forward in the administration.
Thank you, Heather. And I want to pivot just for a moment to talk about some of the other pieces happening around President Trump. Obviously, in the Senate, there continues to be hearings and confirmation votes for a number of cabinet nominees. For our purposes in Independent Sector, we've been watching the process for the Treasury Secretary nominee, Steven Mnuchin. As part of that, Independent Sector submitted questions and a statement for the record to the Senate Finance Committee around that. Their questions were related particularly to how Mr. Mnuchin would continue to service the IRS and the IRS's oversight of the charitable sector, as well as his thoughts and experience around charitable giving and the charitable deduction. Happy to report that Senator Stabenow in particular was very happy and willing to put a couple of those questions related to charitable giving into her official submission for the record. And we are looking forward to receiving or getting some more information back from Mr. Mnuchin and his answers to those questions. But, you know, outside of that process, it seems, Heather, that Mnuchin will be confirmed as Treasury Secretary. Are there other cabinet posts that the nonprofit sector should be looking at very closely or of note, or anything else in the process you think that would be really good to call our attention to?
So I think there's a couple of things about the nomination process that are happening right now. One is the pace. Democrats have been very focused on slowing down the pace. Republicans have been very focused on picking the pace up of these nominations and moving them through the process. Historically, this is slower than the past two Obama administrations and the Bush administrations before that. So we are a little bit behind in the process from where we would typically be. Next week, there are only two nominees that are scheduled to receive their floor votes, Tillerson for state and Chow for transportation. They do have an agreement that it would be possible to add additional nominees to the list next week, but they've been unable to work out agreements between the parties about processing those next week. So we will be looking for some of the more controversial pieces to come in the future, including, I think, the DeVos for Education has been one of the most divisive on the Hill. Secretary Price, the Secretary for HHS, potential Secretary Price for HHS, just received his Senate hearings last week, and there still hasn't been any scheduling for Price, DeVos, or Mnuchin for their floor votes. So we'll be waiting to see if they're able to come to agreement on those here in the next 2 weeks.
Great. Thank you, Heather. And before we pause for questions for a moment, I did want to mention one more news item related to the administration that's popped up in the last week. They're still in process of confirming the new OMB director, who is likely to be now current Representative Mick Mulvaney of South Carolina. The administration is looking to put out some sort of a budget blueprint priority document within the next 45 days. It seems from the news reports that a lot of the inspiration for some of the priorities will be taken directly from the House Republican Study Committee's budget proposal from last year, and maybe even prior budget proposals, more focused on discretionary spending, less on entitlements. I know that it might create some tension within Republican leadership. Certainly there are those who believe that entitlement spending should be part of any conversation, and that will certainly be something to watch as Republicans move their budget priorities. But Heather, I wanted to just to check in with you for a moment to see, based on what we know, what's sort of out there in the news about a Trump administration budget, and again, these are always very political documents, but they do set priorities, and this really will be our first opportunity to see where the Trump administration, kind of wants to allocate resources. Is there anything, A, that sort of concerns you in looking at that document, and B, something that, or how best as a community we might be able to weigh in with the administration as this thing is released?
I think one of the things about a budget document, Jamie, that I think you pointed out correctly, is that the budget document is really a tool to have a conversation with the administration and with the Hill about an administration's priorities. The budget document issued by the president is largely aspirational. Members from both parties will look to it to see the types of pay-fors that the president supports. So as they look to find funding sources for some of their legislation that is upcoming, they'll have a sense of the kinds of priorities that the president would support or would consider including in legislation. I think it does provide some ideas about policy priorities that will allow the sector to go in and have more concrete conversations about what the implications would be of any of the proposals that are in there that might harm a particular sector. Allowing people to put more concrete numbers on the proposals is very helpful in responding to what may have been sort of more high-level talking points previously, and now that we have numbers, you can actually be much more concrete in talking about the implications of the proposals and the policies that would follow from them.
And I'll pull one proposal at random or two just to, as an illustration. But Heather, you know, I think we've seen before calls to eliminate national endowments for the arts and the humanities. Is there a reason in particular for, you know, for this time, this Congress and this administration to be maybe more concerned where we are in the past, or are we really in sort of the same boat? This is starting a conversation. It's, of course, advocacy and education is needed, but is there anything different about now than what we've seen?
Look, I think you have the support of the president and the secretaries, and they've been very clear that they think that there are current government functions that should be privatized and no longer be government functions. And those, you know, I think those are two specific areas that they've been very consistent, and Trump has been consistent. I think it's important to keep in mind, though, that all of this still cannot just be processed by the House alone. All of these policies would have to move through the legislative process. Republicans do not have 60 votes in the Senate that would be required to pass legislation outside of a budget reconciliation process on a partisan basis. Senators run statewide, and so they are responsive to a much broader variety of constituent opinions and needs, and they are responsive to that. So I don't think that people, just because it's in there, should assume that this is a given, but I do think that these are places where it will become very important to figure out where your alliances are, who you can partner with to communicate back to the administration why some of these changes may be damaging in a particular community.
Thank you, Heather. And we're going to pause for a moment to see if there are any questions from on the line. Okay, hearing none. And just a reminder, all lines are technically unmuted at the moment. If you haven't already muted your line, please do so, either the mute function or *6. Heather, I wanted to pivot and mention to the 115th Congress. You mentioned reconciliation, the arcane yet useful budget tool whenever you need to get a simple majority to get something done. It looks like there's a vehicle for repeal of the Affordable Care Act, although we've seen in recent days and weeks that getting that done, getting that completely through, might be a little more difficult as even Republican senators are calling for a more concrete replacement plan. Can you give an update of where things stand and maybe the timeline of how this might shake out?
Yeah, I think this has been a real challenge for Republicans who promised early action on repeal of the ACA. One of the challenges is that, you know, repeal is easy, replace is a lot harder. And as members of the Republican caucus have raised concerns about the politics and effects of repealing without a replacement plan in place, the polling on the ACA has begun to shift. The president has come out and specifically said that there will be a replace when there is repeal, and that they're trying to minimize the loss of coverage that would be expected from any changes. This has become a real policy challenge for Republicans, and so we've seen them sort of shift from their campaign rhetoric to trying to come up with some replacement processes that could be potentially included with the initial reconciliation repeal process of the Affordable Care Act. This means that the process will take longer than just a quick reconciliation vote on the bill that was passed in 2015. And instead, starting to move from, you know, I think the original deadline that was set by the president was, you know, on Inauguration Day, then we saw it move to January 27th. We're seeing that move again, and we're looking towards, you know, beginning action in February in the House, with the stated goal coming out of the Republican retreat this week that they will try to be completed by the beginning of March with this first step in the process. I think they're also starting to talk a lot more publicly that this is going to be a process. It's not a quick one and done. And that there may be several bills, including some that could require the 60-vote threshold, which would require the cooperation of at least 8 Democrats, to do all of the replace pieces that would be necessary to move a more comprehensive healthcare plan forward. So we're seeing, you know, the timeline shifts back a little bit, and we're seeing a lot more discussion about replace, promises that will be forthcoming soon. And I think a little more honesty about the fact that this will be a process that will extend, you know, definitely beyond February, potentially even beyond their March deadline into the spring.
That's very helpful to know. And this is all, and this question is very speculative. And I know there are a number of Democratic senators that will be particularly vulnerable heading into 2018. In your mind, is there anyone that stands out to you that might be among the first kind of to cross over and be a little more supportive of this replacement effort? So far, everyone seems to be holding ranks, but, you know, as we get closer, there may be opportunities to make some other decisions.
Sure. I would say that, you know, just from the sense of being on the Hill, that I would say that the Democratic senators have been incredibly cohesive in their opposition, perhaps more cohesive on this issue than I've seen them on issues in the last few years. So there, despite the fact that there are Democrats that are in very conservative states that were won by a significant margin by President Trump, I think you see a lot of consistent messaging coming out of the Democratic caucus from both the House and the Senate, even those senators that are in tough reelection races. I will say, because you asked the question specifically, there have been a number of senators that have come out on the record and specifically offered to Republicans that if they want to work with them on making changes to the ACA that would assure the same level of coverage and the same value of coverage for Americans, that they would welcome those conversations. It doesn't appear that anyone has been taken up on their offer to have those conversations. I think Joe Manchin from West Virginia came out and said, look, if somebody wants to have a conversation about maintaining coverage and how we move forward and do that, I'm happy to have that conversation. But so far, this continues to be a partisan process.
Thanks, Heather. And for those of you on the call, we're actually fortunate. If you haven't had a chance to take a look on our website or haven't seen the emails, we have started a new 100 Days for Good podcast series, one podcast a week for the first 100 days of the new administration and new Congress to talk about, you know, various issues impacting the sector. We're actually going to have Heather next week talk with us a little bit more about the process and the practical implications around ACA repeal and replace. So looking forward to that, Heather, and thanks for giving us a little bit of a preview today on that piece.
But, that's,
you know,
a good stuff for next week, Jamie.
That's right. but, you know, part two of this reconciliation piece, at least stated by Republican leadership, is this idea of trying to get closer to a comprehensive tax reform package, a complete rewrite in a way we have not seen in a number of years. I know the Ways and Means Committee currently is drafting based off their blueprint released over the summer. There's been some discussion, at least that, you know, I've had on the Hill, with there being interest and maybe some inspiration drawn from the camp draft from a couple of years ago on a few items of how to polish things. Certainly the Trump administration, when it was the Trump campaign, had a few ideas they put out late summer about how to structure the tax code. I think that getting a little closer in line with what Chairman Brady has put out there. But, you know, this process is beginning to move, although I get the sense that if the longer that we have to work and we're looking at ACA, the further this may be kicked down in the can into the year, maybe even into the fall, stretching out. But the point being, there clearly is a drive we have not seen in a while to get this done. I'm wondering what you've heard, particularly on the committee level or from leadership, about their thoughts on process and timing.
So they are very concerned that because the ACA process is extended beyond their initial deadline, so that does move back a lot of the more public efforts around tax reform and pushing it later into the spring. The Republicans are at a retreat this weekend together, both Senate and House. President Trump, Vice President Pence, and British Prime Minister May are all there today, and they're talking a lot about the agenda. Yesterday, Speaker Ryan laid out a timeline for the members where he walked through sort of that process of, you know, what are we doing for the next 6 months? And, you know, first up, you have the ACA process with that terminating, with their goal of terminating that in March. There are a number of other activities that will have to take place. The potentially discussions around the budget will take place again in April. And they want to start that tax reform process in the spring with a goal of finishing it up by the August recess, putting pressure on members to come together quickly when the new draft is released and try to get behind it so that they can push forward. The fact is that because the process and the drafting process is less public than it has been in the past, and they're working very hard to have a draft done and completed that will be put out without a lot of public input into it initially, there are a number of very contentious policies that are driving a lot of dialogue in Washington, and those pieces are going to have to be worked out. Whether that happens before or after the draft comes out will also, you know, sort of determine the speed at which it's able to move. This means that it's very possible that we could also see the timing around tax reform slip beyond that August recess and into the fall, despite the fact that many members are, particularly in the House, would like, and in the Senate, would like to get beyond the ACA repeal and replace process and move into tax reform, where they feel they have a positive message to share and would prefer to be working on tax reform over ACA repeal and replace.
Heather, it seems that outside of a few conversations and working groups a couple years ago, there hasn't been much concrete in the Senate around tax reform. Do you get the sense, I mean, obviously because of the numbers alone, that may be more of a public and bipartisan effort. I assume they're not just going to take what the House puts forward as gospel and try to move that through.
They are senators, and they do like to have their say. However, when you put pen to paper first, you usually do have an advantage in what the final product looks like. That is accurate. The Senate does not have an active drafting process that is ongoing at this time. Chairman Hatch has been meeting with his members to get a sense of their priorities and perspectives on proposals that have been floating out there, to understand what their concerns are and to prepare for the process. This is different than on the House side, where the Ways and Means Committee and their tax staff are actively drafting legislative language that they intend to release as the first draft of the tax reform bill. So the process is very different on the House and the Senate side. The Senate will certainly have input into the process, and it will be interesting to see how they decide to move the legislation. It's possible that the tax reform legislation could move through regular order through both the House and the Senate, which would require hearings at the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee, which would create an opportunity for more amendment as it moves through the congressional bodies. That would also mean that there would be an opportunity for more Democratic amendments in that kind of an environment, because they would need to get to 60 votes in the Senate again. If that doesn't seem like it will be a tenable political approach, it is possible, and one thing that is under active discussion, is if they would use an additional reconciliation package that would allow them to again move the legislation with 51 votes, just a majority vote, which would allow them to move the legislation on a partisan basis without any Democratic votes. So they're thinking through sort of the politics and the possibility about how they move this. But certainly the most active legislative work is certainly happening on the House side at the Ways and Means Committee.
And I want to flag one thing for the group before we open up for questions, is that there was a report today, and it's consistent with some of the conversations that we've had with committee staff on the House side, but Chairman Brady has said publicly several times within the past couple of months that the committee, with respect to charitable giving and tax reform, are looking for ways to unlock more giving, and are looking in particular at ways to get to individuals and families who may be on the cusp in between the itemizing and non-itemizing space, younger potential donors, and those in the lower to middle income bracket. One of the ideas that independent sector has been talking about with staff and with members for at least the past 7 months is the idea of a non-itemizer deduction, or opening up the charitable deduction to all taxpayers regardless of their tax status. That, you know, did get some conceptual support from members, and unclear whether or not it has any momentum in the drafting stage, but the fact that the chairman is speaking publicly about, you know, finding ways to do this as part of their drafting is certainly encouraging for us We're going to keep up the drumbeat. You'll be seeing more. Hopefully you saw the request from Dan earlier this week on the asset mapping to get an opportunity to learn more about some of the sector relationships of the very targeted members of Congress, but we will be following up with even more opportunities in the coming weeks and months to reach out to your members of Congress to talk about this idea. We certainly think that a non-itemizer, and within the bigger context of what they want to do, might be a helpful way to encourage more giving. But something we're monitoring actively and we're having conversations about, but wanted to flag it that very positively the statements have been good in terms of the deduction in charitable giving and tax reform thus far. So I'll pause for a minute now to open up for any questions. Okay, hearing none. Heather, there's one thing that I neglected to talk about with respect to the Trump administration, and it's the fact that now we have a date set for his first address to Congress on February 28th. And just curious, I mean, typically presidents have taken this opportunity, at least new administrations, to really outline broad-scale priorities. You know, it is an opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the campaign promises and things they want to do. Any signals? I mean, more so than any other administration in recent memory, you know, for a number of reasons, but certainly it seems harder to read exactly, you know, what might be on President Trump's mind as they're looking forward to this. Any intel, any insight into how that address may take shape?
No, I think one thing that's been happening in Washington is that people are, you know, coming to understand more how the president thinks and works. And he is turning out very much to be a man of his word. And at the Republican retreat, you know, the area where he received one of the, you know, largest rounds of applause was when he told the members of Congress that he would work with them, you know, on the Affordable Care Act, and he would work with them on tax reform, and he would use the bully pulpit to reinforce the Republican message and their work and to keep everybody on board and focused on those two issues. So because of the timing on February 28th, we do expect that, you know, a portion of this will focus on the ACA repeal and replace. We'll talk about his priorities and the steps that he has taken to make good on his campaign promises related to reducing the size of government, building a wall, the changes with respect to immigration, touting the action that he's already taken and that he is a man of action and a man of his word. We expect that he will also continue some of the outreach. This week also saw him reaching out to a number of Democrats and looking for areas where he might find some strange bedfellows to work on policies that have been campaign promises. One of those areas is infrastructure, where he spent time meeting with and reaching out to some of the labor unions to discuss his interest in infrastructure, with Democrats sending back their infrastructure plan, asking him to focus on infrastructure as an area of consensus. We also saw him reaching out to you know, liberal members of the House who have been strong critics of high drug prices, and offering to work with them to bring down drug pricing. This is an area where Republicans have been opposed to action in this area, but Trump has a particular perspective on it that doesn't match his conference, and so he's, you know, looking for allies. So, you know, I think we would expect him to continue to focus on those themes and to echo the themes that we heard in his inaugural address.
Thank you, Heather. Another piece with respect to the campaign, the Trump campaign, now the administration, and part of the Republican Party platform, something we've been following very closely with our partners at the Bright Lines Project and Public Citizen and others, is this idea of potentially repealing the Johnson Amendment. And for some context, the Johnson Amendment, first introduced by then Senator Lyndon Johnson and approved in 1954, is a provision in the Internal Revenue Code that actually prohibits 501c3s from intervening in political campaigns or, you know, taking steps that are really, that would be considered political activity. There was some discussion around that, particularly within the context of, I think, certain religious institutions at the time over the summer. I think that the speech that Trump made was in front of a group of evangelicals at that point. There was a legislation introduced in the House at the end of last year by Representatives Scalise and Heiss around this, called the Free Speech Fairness Act of 114th at the end of last year. The issue has gone a little dormant as we're just in the first few weeks of the year, but wondering and if there may be the case there hasn't been much public activity or conversation about this at all, but wondering if that is still an item of potential concern. As you said, the president has thus far shown himself to be a man of his word in terms of his priorities, and this was a part of the platform. So if there's any context, this may be coming up in the coming months, if there's anything that you might be able to shed some light on.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything specific to that as a priority yet, Jamie.
Thank you. And again, this is something that we'll be monitoring very closely. Hard to read the tea leaves at this point. I think it would have to come up within a broader context, but don't know. So I'll pause here just for a moment to see if anyone has any questions. Okay, hearing none. Another update for the group. As you may recall, last year we had a discussion about the Digital Accountability and Transparency Act, also known as the DATA Act. The DATA Act requires the government to standardize all of its financial information so that it can be analyzed across contracts, programs, and agencies. There is a Section 5 pilot program administered by the Department of Health and Human Services that provides nonprofits the opportunity to provide needed feedback to government and policymakers about the federal grant making process. We discussed a number of pilots last year throughout our monthly calls. A lot of them are underway. Although we just learned that there's another opportunity to provide the government with feedback on how to improve the single audit process associated with the federal reporting. If you're interested in providing your feedback in the single audit test model, please contact Data Act PMO at hhs.gov. We'll share this email address with you with the recording of this call early next week. It's our understanding, again, this is one of the last opportunities around the Data Act pilot programs to submit your thoughts and to make an impact with that. And we'll continue to monitor and update as we learn more around the Data Act. So Heather, before we jump off today's call and kind of wrap up, want to ask you, is there any other big ticket items, anything that we haven't discussed today? I mean, certainly we'll learn more about the president's potential Supreme Court nominee next week and what that might look like. But is there anything with a particular relevance to the nonprofit community that we should have on our radar screen in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I think everybody should be following the president on Twitter if they're not already. That will continue to be a source of news in this administration. Where we continue to learn new things. I think, for example, I was going to raise the Supreme Court nominee as the example, but you took my example. The president did announce that next Thursday he will be announcing his Supreme Court nominee. And a lot of observers in Washington thought that that decision would come later because it's potentially going to be one that could be viewed as contentious on the Hill, and that he might try to wait because they're working on so many issues so quickly. But the president did announce on Twitter that he will be announcing his Supreme Court nominee next Thursday. So I think we will continue to see executive orders and action in the interim while we wait for Congress to move forward through the legislative process related to the ACA and tax reform.
And Heather, I'm sure given the campaign and the first week or so, we're all shocked that social media may be the best place to get the most up-to-date information about what the president's thinking and where the administration may be going. But that's certainly a good tip. And whether it's 3 in the morning or 3 in the afternoon, there's generally something with a nugget of information that might be helpful about anything we're doing. So thank you for that. I wanted to one last time plug our podcast series, an opportunity to take a different dive on a number of the issues. We really appreciate feedback on that. Podcast at independentsector.org. Visit our website at independentsector.org. Check out episode 2 went up today. We talked a little bit more about reconciliation with Sarah Egge, one of Heather's colleagues. at Washington Council. It was a good opportunity. It was a lot of fun, a lot less wonky and entertaining than I would have expected in a conversation about reconciliation and a good tool. But the feedback does help us plan and think about future podcasts and the types of topics and opportunities to hear from you as well. And there may be those of you out there on the phone or those in your networks who would be great to participate in one of these podcasts. We'd like to know that too, to talk about particular issues. Following the call within the next week, we'll send out a recording of today's call and links to the Data Act information that we mentioned. There'll also be a survey embedded link. We call it it's a Rocket Up survey. It's very short, very brief. One of the things we're most concerned about is designing programming that matters to you and that is helpful in your work. If you prefer these monthly updates to strictly be conference call format, that's good for us to know. If you want us to take another shot at the webinar format for certain issues, we're happy to do that too. But again, we just want to find ways to keep you engaged and provide information as quickly and as best as we can. So really appreciate your time today for being on with us. Heather, thank you so much for joining us and for being a great resource. Look forward to talking to you next week about the Affordable Care Act. And we will talk to you all again in February with our next monthly policy update. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you.